Bitcoin crushing Ethereum, treasury yields, bond volatility, the money markets, and of course, the election, and what impact it will have on financial markets. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, I have a massive chart pack for you guys. We're going to go through Bitcoin, the treasury yield curve. We're going to talk about TBL liquidity, our new metric to track financial markets. We'll get into money markets and the Fed's balance sheet, and we'll talk about debt to GDP and whether or not the election will have any impact on what happens to the overall US Treasury debt situation. All right, let's get started with the Bitcoin chart. I have for you a descending trend line that has been in place since March. Now, Bitcoin is in a consolidation since March, so a little over 6 months, and what you have are lower highs for Bitcoin. And lower highs are either a bearish sign or a sign of consolidation. We're going to assume here that Bitcoin is consolidating after a large, very brief parabolic move from January to March of this year. Now, looking at where Bitcoin has gone over the last few trading sessions, yes, Bitcoin did close above this trend line for a few days, but has since given back and is still trading right around the trend line. Now, I have posted some charts from TradingView, which are candlesticks. These macro bond charts do not contain intraday price action, so they are just looking at daily closes. But I want to explain why I use these trend lines and why they need to be taken with a grain of salt. The trend lines are a general behavioral impulse for the market. So this general impulse here is sell Bitcoin when it gets to almost the level that it was previously peaking at. That's the descending trend line. So when Bitcoin's price is consolidating this way, we cannot assume that 1 or 2 days of closes above a line that I have drawn connecting a few peaks, and the ones that I do using the candlesticks that you guys have seen me use in our last video and the ones that I often tweet, those trend lines that connect candles from March until now are, it's only an estimate, meaning that what I'm doing is giving the general shape of the market behavior, but the exact line and where it falls cannot be taken as religion. And what we can do, though, is use that line for a behavioral signal. So when the price gets above that line but doesn't show any momentum and then trades back down below, we can say that that resistance was respected. And it does appear that Bitcoin is continuing to respect this resistance, even though it traded above it for a couple days. Now, if we were, let's say, a trading service or a hedge fund, we would be looking at signals that are much more exact, perhaps, to trigger trades or not. But we are not a trading service at TBL. We're a research provider, and our goal is to give you a sense of where the market is or where it might be heading. What we can say based on our analysis is that until Bitcoin can not only just close above this resistance, but convincingly close above it for a couple weeks and then show immediate strength, then we can suggest that yes, Bitcoin is ready for its next phase of its bull cycle. But because we're not a trading service, we don't have to put a timing on it or be more specific than, hey, we want to see Bitcoin's price close above this line and then again close above it and then show strength and confirm that this resistance is now support. But we cannot do that yet. The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by Unchained, the undisputed leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults, in which you own two of three keys and you gain a Bitcoin security partner. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage via Unchained's trading desk and eliminate all exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA in the industry, where you can convert your existing 401ks or retirement accounts to Unchained, all while keeping control of your Bitcoin private keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Talk to Unchained today. Go to unchained.com/TBL for $100 off when you sign up. Ifani is a secure mobile carrier that helps prevent SIM swaps. SIM swaps are sophisticated social engineering attacks in which hackers steal your phone number by gaining access to your information. Ifani lets you sign up with AT&T or Verizon through them, but Ifani protects your mobile number from being stolen by hackers. So make sure you're protecting those online accounts. Go to ifani.com/TBL for $99 off when you sign up. Moving quickly to Bitcoin versus Ethereum. This chart is a market cap ratio between the two cryptocurrencies. So Ethereum trading at around $300 billion of market cap. Bitcoin trading above $1.3 trillion of market cap. So above 4 1/3 times the size of Ethereum. That is where Bitcoin is right now. That is less relevant than the trend. We can see here that Bitcoin was about twice the size of Ethereum just a couple years ago. Now it's 4 times. So an absolute domination of Bitcoin in terms of the marginal capital coming into the crypto sphere. And we like to see Bitcoin increasing its dominance, especially versus large cryptocurrencies, not just versus all these meme coins out there. But we like to see Bitcoin taking more and more of the marginal capital. And I would recommend people go check out our episode from earlier this week with Alex Thorne, in which he explains very interestingly that because Bitcoin didn't have regulated vehicles available to the investment public a couple years ago, a lot of VC money came, or let's just say institutional money, came into this industry hoping to get exposure to Bitcoin, but instead was only able to put money or invest money in venture capital firms that invest in crypto, which in the VC field, a lot of those projects are non-Bitcoin projects, including Ethereum projects. Now we have Bitcoin ETFs, so a new capital allocator will come to this industry and say, I want to be long Bitcoin, how do I do it? Long a Bitcoin ETF. Very easy for them to do that, as opposed to having to go get exposure via venture capital firms that aren't really investing in Bitcoin. They're not buying Bitcoin. Some of them are building Bitcoin adjacent infrastructure, but that doesn't mean the capital is flowing into Bitcoin. Now we can see that just based off of this chart, only this chart, that capital is coming into Bitcoin versus Ethereum. And we can make the leap and make that connection to Alex's research and suggest that, yes, these ETFs are providing that avenue. Now, I have heard a lot of your questions out there. You're saying, hey, ETF flows are dynamic. There's a lot of capital coming in. Why isn't the price going up more? Or where is the money going if it's not going to price? Remember that ETFs are only one segment of the market, and they can be used in a lot of cross arbitrage opportunities, such as going long an ETF or short a futures contract or vice versa, and trying to capture some sort of risk-free basis. So in treasury land, we call the basis trade long futures and short the cash instrument, or long cash, meaning I'm long a bond and short futures. In that way, you're involved in a basis trade, either long or short, and you're hoping to arbitrage between a physical good, which in this case is a treasury security or a bond, an actual U.S. government obligation versus a derivatives product that promises to deliver said obligation. And if those two have prices that are divergent today and will allow a risk-free arbitrage in the future, that attracts a basis trade. That type of dynamic is happening in Bitcoin, and there is no way for us to know how much of the Bitcoin ETF inflows are directly related to the basis trade versus raw investment. Now, I will say, though, we have covered this year that the holdings page of the Bloomberg screens show us who the holders are of these securities. Now, we get them from Bloomberg, but we can also get them from public disclosures. And what we will see over time is that some, I don't know if it's a quarter, a half, three quarters, some of the Bitcoin ETF inflows are genuine long-term capital allocators that are buying and holding. Okay, so real hodlers in the Bitcoin ETF sphere. We don't know how many, but or how much, or the percentage, but we know that they're there because they're showing up. We know Wisconsin and Michigan at the state pension level are already involved. A massive signpost for institutional adoption, these Midwestern states getting involved. But through time, we will see more institutions make these disclosures, and then we can say, okay, this is real long-term capital. I know a lot of you guys are really wanting to see that direct correlation between Bitcoin ETF inflows and the Bitcoin price, but I cannot say that that is going to be the case today or tomorrow in the future. What we know is that Bitcoin is a global market. There are thousands of ways to buy Bitcoin, and there are, frankly, now over 100 ways, or let's just say 100 different individual markets for Bitcoin that are robust. And I'm talking about nearly a dozen exchanges that are US and European based that are widely used, a dozen more exchanges that are Asian based that are widely used. You're talking about ETF vehicles all over the world, futures markets on Binance that are global as well. And so all of these markets are, they all have their own price, and buyers and sellers are trying to arbitrage between them in addition to get long, which you guys are focused on. Now, I don't know how many of you are out there actively arbitraging one Bitcoin market and the other, either an exchange in Korea and an exchange in the United States, or an exchange in the United States and the CME futures. I know most of you are probably not doing that, but you have to be aware that that type of activity is going on. Not only is it prevalent, but it's healthy for Bitcoin because it puts us in a more mature asset class environment. That type of activity, I don't know what that will do to volatility. It's my suspicion that volatility will be dampened over the long term because of these maturing markets. But I've said this before, to the naked eye, I don't think that volatility will go down in Bitcoin, meaning it is very likely to have $10,000 and $20,000 one-day swings in this Bitcoin price over the next year. In my next chart, I present TBL liquidity. This is our new metric that we are using at the Bitcoin layer in order to measure the appetite for risk assets. So make sure you subscribe to our free research publication at thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe and consider becoming a TBL Pro to gain exclusive access to our Monday report, Mean Median Mode, which we publish every Monday morning to give you the risk outlook across the entire global macro sphere, including interest rates, the stock market, but most importantly, Bitcoin. Now, in this metric that we have built, there are three major components. Number one is the asset side of the financial system, so banks and central banks and their asset side of the balance sheet. Number two, the price on U.S. Treasuries. So as rates go up and down, our metric goes up and down. Lastly, bond volatility, measured by the MOVE Index. And as bond volatility goes up, it is a potential risk for the markets, and we will explain why that is. For those of you who want a much deeper dive on TBL liquidity and the metric, we produced a video recently about understanding what moves the Bitcoin market. And in our study, we have determined that not only the size of the banking system is affecting asset prices, but also bond volatility. Why does that happen? Because as bond volatility spikes, as it goes up, the holdings of these banks, which are to a great degree, treasury securities and other government bonds, those government bonds themselves give the banks ability to print money and to create new money, either through the repo market or other collateralization. And risk markets respond very well to growing bank balance sheets and low bond volatility, because low bond volatility allows the banks who own treasuries to multiply those treasuries throughout the system by creating new liability asset pairs, either via the loan market or other sort of repo market activity, margin borrowing, margin lending. All of this stuff takes place due to low volatility and market making. When bond volatility spikes, it is a sign that market makers are stepping away from the market. They are less willing to sell you insurance. They are less willing to make the market. And when they step away, guess what happens to the whole system's ability to create money and stoke that demand for asset prices or assets themselves? It is the bond volatility itself that is what we've determined to be the primary driver of that money creation. And so low bond vol, high ability for banks to create money, high bond volatility, less market making, less money creation, lower asset prices. So if you guys want an ongoing analysis of TBL liquidity and everything that we're doing at the Bitcoin layer, definitely consider becoming a TBL pro today at thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. Now, of late, bond volatility has spiked. We covered this in our video this week about treasury prices that are currently in a bit of a free fall, as interest rates have gone up about 60 basis points in the 10-year part of the curve. Now, accordingly, TBL liquidity, which we show you here in purple, has declined significantly over the last few weeks, as not only have rates risen, but bond vol has spiked in accordance. Now, why hasn't the stock market been hit yet? Well, we see a little bit of weakness this week in the stock market, but we are believing that we're going through a bit of a regime shift in the markets right now, in which the previous correlations of high rates, lower stocks, and low rates, higher stocks is giving way to a little bit more of a pro-growth environment in which deficits will be high, the yield curve will potentially steepen, but TBL liquidity, which measures the size of the financial system, will continue to expand off of very large deficits. We believe that this is the case, and so it means that in the short term, bond vol might threaten risk markets, but in the more medium term, we believe the size of the financial system will win out. And so it is our effort here to try to measure the way markets are moving and give you our best analysis, which is right now, hey, a spike in bond volatility puts these risk markets at risk. Here's a chart of 10-year yields as we go deeper into the treasury market here. The 10-year yield has traded back up to 4.25% here off of about 3.6. And we look at this level between 4.25 and 4.33 as an extremely important area for 10-year yields. I can't stress this enough, to be very honest with you guys. Why? Because above 4.33, it tells me that the narrative of growth slowing broadly and a desire to hide out in treasuries is completely gone from the market. I won't say that yet because we basically retraced the initial move lower in yields, which is not necessarily bearish by itself. But if rates go from, let's say, 4.33 to 4.5, you are going to hear a very different analyst out of me about what's going on in the broader market. Until that happens, though, we just have to flag that there is a current wave of fear in the market that we will only see resolve once we see how the price behaves around 4.25 to 4.33% on tens. Now, I have 4.33 in red here. You see that yields are drawn back up to that level. It's been a swing point over the last couple years. And my base case is that it will hold as I feel that the labor market is continuing to deteriorate. I have a chart on the labor market for you a little bit later in this video, so stay tuned for that. But the overall impulse of the economy due to my outlook on the labor market and housing market is still modestly lower. And so I can't envision higher yields off of that base case. But I'm a price is truth guy, so I have to change my tune if the price tells me to do so. And I'm flagging this chart to show you guys that I am right there at that precipice of having to change my narrative if the price goes against this red line. And by against, I mean above. And remember our Bitcoin chart there when I was talking about the resistance line. It's not just one close. It's what happens around that level and then subsequently what happens. So if tens trade to 4.33, then they get to 4.4, but then they come all the way back down to 4% over the next few weeks. Nothing happened. Nothing was confirmed, right? If Bitcoin gets above 68,000-70,000 here this week, but comes back down to 58K, as I know many of you think it might do, there's nothing to conclude yet. It's basically continuing its current trend. And so remember, the trend persists. We have to look to identify the trend. And our job here is to flag when a trend is changing, because that's going to make a big difference. And so what was the big trend that we saw change? It already happened. It wasn't higher yields. It was higher yields with higher stocks. That was new. And that was a change. So we flagged that for everybody that was reading and watching these videos. Now we'll watch 4.33 to see, okay, is there something new here? Meaning, are we in for higher yields? This next chart is a contribution of that 10-year yield. So we'll move the 10-year yield here up to the top in purple. But in red and green, you have the additive components of that 10-year yield. They are the real yield, so the yield on tips, which is represented in green, and then the inflation break-even, which is basically a subtraction problem, the purple line minus the green line. And by doing that, the red line gives us what is the inflation expectation that's baked in to a 10-year yield of 4.25, when the real yield is at about 2%, or the tips yield. It tells us how much inflation is in those two prices to make them even. That's why it's called an inflation break-even. Why do I go to the components when a big move happens in yield? I want to see what's driving it. Is there a large jump in inflation expectations, or is there a less willingness to hold the asset class? And I think it's the latter, represented by an increase in real yields more so than the increase in inflation expectations, which have also ticked up. So both of these internals have ticked up on the current move higher. It tells me that it can't just be a consolidation. There's something else to it. There is a fear component in it. Is the fear component related to Donald Trump returning to the White House in January? It could be, because we know that tax cuts will be extended or even increased, meaning even lower taxes. That should suggest a very large deficit will probably bring the need to issue more 10s, 20s, and 30s as opposed to doing all the issuance in bills. If we get those longer-term issuances, that does increase the premium that a long-term Treasury investor would demand to make that investment. We saw this entire story play out about a year ago when Yellen hit the market with more coupons. And so what the Treasury does matters, but the Treasury is only going to do what Congress tells it when it signs the when it passes the budget and the president signs it. And so the Treasury Department is just acting on behalf of the government. The government is the actor that spends the money, that decides to spend the money. And all of that money, it does appear that the markets are worried about what will be spent. And by markets, I mean 30-year Treasury investors are worried about a Trump presidency and potentially Republican control of the House, which would allow much larger deficits. It's funny to think that the Republican Party is allegedly the fiscally conservative one, but if you look at the numbers, the Republican Party are large deficit spenders over the last few administrations that have had that chance. And so what we are doing is we are analyzing the market and translating backwards into the narrative. The market is telling you Trump is not good for 30s. And it actually makes sense to me that there would be a bid, meaning buying 30-year bonds, if there was going to be a Harris presidency because of an alleged lack of growth, that Harris policies would not be supportive to growth. So buy treasuries, buy 30s. And that is how we must analyze this market. Yields up, Trump coming back. Yields down, Trump not coming back. And so the market is telling us the way that the election will go in a couple weeks, and that's what we're doing. We're interpreting the market. We also are interpreting that a Trump presidency will lead to tax cuts and or large deficits. Now, those large deficits will hit 10s, 20s, and 30s and steepen out the yield curve, but there is a chance that the amount of money that is borrowed and spent will happen to a large degree in the bill part of the curve. Therefore, being extremely expansionary to TBL liquidity, which is a measure of the size of the banking system. So if banks absorb those T-bills as governments borrow and spend, then that will be extremely expansionary for the financial system, and it will make TBL liquidity go up, which has a strong above 50% correlation with the S&P 500. And that is why we built the metric, because we're not just creating a model for fun. We're doing it to give us predictive power over the largest risk market in the world, which is the S&P 500. The S&P 500 does have, from time to time, an outsized influence on Bitcoin. We're not trying to relate Bitcoin directly to TBL liquidity because we're not idiots. We know that Bitcoin is a new asset class and is not going to necessarily show a great correlation to every macro component all the time. It's going to decouple. It's too young. But it stays linked with the stock market a large percentage of the time because it is maturing. So that's why we do that two-step TBL liquidity to stocks and then stocks to Bitcoin. So again, if you want to focus on this and track this with us, every Monday, mean, median, mode is your place to do it. Consider becoming a TBL pro today at thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. Let's continue with the treasury market here. I want to show you the twos, tens yield curve so you can see that, yes, we've had a large move higher in tens, but it hasn't come with a dramatic steepening of the yield curve. In fact, yields are a little less steep than they were a few weeks ago. You can see that the peak at about 17 basis points between twos, tens, it's a little off that 25 basis point level we got to a few weeks ago. So the increase in 10-year yields is not accompanied by a dramatic steepening of the yield curve. That suggests to me that buying might be coming back in as we get to that 4 1/3 level. Again, one of the reasons why I believe that that 4 1/3 level is so important to watch. Now, the next chart shows our move regimes. Now, we've gone through a few different regimes over the last decade. The 2015, 16, 17 era, muted volatility, rates at zero, and climbing in a very, very slow, slow pace, a quarter basis point at every quarter of a meeting. So over a 2 to 3 year period, rates were increased from zero to just above 2%. So no volatility, no uncertainty. Then, of course, the pandemic, but then a huge increase in volatility. This is this first green line higher 2021 and 2022 off of inflation wave. Why does bond vol go up on inflation? Fear of owning a fixed income instrument in an inflationary environment because your real return is clobbered. So you sell, and that's why vol went up. And the market makers were not really ready to sell all of that insurance because they knew they would have to pay out if rates continued to go higher, which they did. Then a recent, over the last year plus, less bond volatility as rates have come down. Why? Inflation came back down. But I put a new line here, a little second green line, to show you that maybe it is a new regime. Maybe this Trump presidency is going to mean something materially different over the last 2 years here with reducing inflation just coming back down, tariffs, deficits off of the back of lower taxes, higher growth impulse, potentially still lower policy rates that will potentially stoke borrowing again. All of these things are inflationary. And if the bond volatility, again, 4 1/3, if we get above that 4 1/3 level, you can expect that there will be a new round of insurance buying, put buying. Anybody long treasuries, they will need put options. They will need insurance. Market makers will have to make that market. Move will go up. Bond volatility will go up. TBL liquidity, mathematically, it will go down because it's an inverse in our index, and it might even be too strongly weighted. We're working on that. We're toying with the index all the time to try to make sure that it is giving us not false signal, but real signal. So TBL liquidity will decline. That could hit risk markets. So it's something that we really have to watch. This regime shift in the correlation between treasuries and stocks that we flagged a couple weeks ago might just be the beginning of a larger regime shift in which we're done with the disinflation wave that we have been pounding the table on for basically 2 years. And we were early to it. We were early. We said inflation is calming. It didn't really calm as much as we thought. It has, but that wave, the market is telling you it might be over, not me, right? I'm not a big narratives guy. I'm not trying to sell you a narrative. I'm actually just interpreting the price and then giving you the narrative that is the most appropriate one. I do try to get ahead of the curve and give you next month's narrative, 3 months' narrative. Well, I'm telling you, this is what the market is telling us. It's telling us Trump returns. He probably has at least 300 electoral votes. He's going to get close to majority in the House. He's going to have a majority in the Senate. It's going to mean lower taxes, higher deficits. It's going to mean more tariffs. It could mean Robert Lighthizer as the U.S. Treasury Secretary. If you want to know about Lighthizer, go watch our episode about Trump coming back and what that could mean from the Lighthizer perspective. 60% tariffs. So these are the things that we are watching right now, and we will let the market guide the narrative so that we're not grasping at what we believe will happen and instead just telling you what is happening. Okay, I want to talk about financial conditions really quickly. This is the Chicago Fed's National Financial Conditions Index. It combines not only bond volatility, but mostly these really internal components to market making in the financial sector. So repo spreads, asset-backed security spreads, what is the volatility of options on interest rate swaps? So these types, and of course, other corporate spreads. So these fixed income dominant metrics give us a very broad gauge of what we try to measure with MOVE, which is market making. So market making, when it's going well, financial conditions are easy and stocks can go up and everything can go up. And conditions are easy. And this is what I'm trying to show you here. Over the last 2 years, financial conditions have gotten easier and easier. This index resets once every week. So the interest rate increase that we've had since the Fed cut rates on September 18th, it's in this metric here. And you don't really see it, meaning conditions have only gotten easier since the Fed cut. So broadly, MOVE, of course, has spiked as the Treasury market has gone into a little bit of a tailspin here, but it might be that the Treasury market itself is responding to something internal, such as the premium that 30-year investors will need to, that they will demand for their return from the government and from the market if we do have that change in administration here in a couple weeks. And so easy financial conditions like you see on this chart can be an explainer for why stocks are doing so well despite spiking bond volatility. Another question I've heard is why have mortgage rates gone up since the Fed cut? Because we know mortgage rates trade based off of tens, not the Fed funds part of the curve. And if tens have gone up, as tens have gone up, so have mortgage yields. So if the Fed really wants to save the housing market from some sort of crisis, 50 basis points is not going to do anything. They need to cut rates by about 3% to get that market going, meaning bring policy rates below 3%. They're priced to come back below 4% by mid to early next year, but that's not going to be enough to get the housing market back on its feet. We had really quite mediocre home sales data this week, just to show you that even though prices haven't come down, the market is saturated a little bit right now with existing homes. They're just not moving at any really solid pace here. Quickly on the U.S. economy, this morning on Thursday, October 24th, we had the number of continuing claims reach a new cycle high, about 1.9 million people collecting continuing jobless claims. This is a sign that the labor market is not strong. And without a strong labor market, you can't really have a strong forward consumer. I know the spot consumer is doing fine. We see that in the retail sales data, but it's not going to just convince me that everything is going well with the economy looking to next year when we see unemployment and continuing claims going up. Let's switch to global FX and the dollar. The dollar has responded very well to the increase in US interest rates. So you see that move higher in the dollar up to 104 off of the 100 level. Strong dollar is a little bit dangerous for global markets. So the recent moves in treasury yields have not really hit the stock market yet until this week. Neither has the dollar. But if either of these things continue to go higher, and it really will be driven by yields, yields first, dollar higher, it will be a tighter financial condition and on the global market and something that we are going to want to watch for. Now, one of the ways that the US government plus central bank can make sure that the dollar doesn't rise too much is to print more dollars, to increase the supply of dollars. One of the ways to do that is to issue T-bills. And why would you issue T-bills? When you borrow and spend. And so when we talk about borrow and spending, T-bill issuance is the main funder of that borrow and spend. And when T-bills are issued, it does calm the dollar. So if you want to see the dollar come down and you're the government, just print more money. And the government will do that, we believe, to a great degree here when we get into 2025 and the government starts to get into its new rhythm, what tax cuts are coming, what type of spending programs are going to go through. And in that way, we might see a large influx in bills and then potentially a calming of the dollar, which would be bullish for risk assets. I should say that on TBL liquidity, the way that it has come down off of bond volatility spiking should make risk longs nervous in the stock market here. So Bitcoin has shown an increasing correlation to the stock market over the last few months. So definitely a strong relationship. Bitcoin is also there in the crosshairs with the move index spiking and TBL liquidity falling. Now let's get into inflation. I want to talk about inflation and whether we're going to see inflation really see another wave coming back. Bills will be the tell here. So in red, you have the percentage of bills versus the marketable treasury securities out there. Bills at 21%. If we see more bills, we're going to see more inflation because bills means borrow and spend. It means the government is printing money. Now, I am going to give you guys an episode here over the next few days in which I break down the borrow and spend and how it increases the size of the financial system. But until that day, look at the amount of bills and how it relates to the overall treasury supply. If that number goes up, you can definitely expect higher spot inflation. Now, the US government debt to GDP sits right around 120% here in red. This is leveling off over the last few years as now GDP and the debt are pretty much rising at a one-for-one level. But I want to show you in the next chart that what I believe the main driver to GDP will be inflation itself. So inflation coming down below 2.5% today suggests that the US government can't inflate its debt away. It's not generating enough tax receipts to get that debt to GDP ratio down. It's not generating enough nominal GDP. But if it can get inflation up as it did in 2021 and 2022, we can actually see debt to GDP decline. So if the government wants to see debt to GDP decline, it has to get inflation up. This is financial repression. It has to be their goal to regulate debt to GDP. Now, we can see actually that the government is failing in its goal to get inflation if its goal is to get down debt to GDP. So right now, the government will talk out of both sides of its mouth. They want to get inflation down so that people are not mad about policies and mad at Congress, but behind closed doors, they understand that inflation is the only way to handle the real debt load. It's to decrease the size of the debt load on a real basis by increasing the size of the notional GDP and the notional economy itself. And one of the easiest ways to do that is inflation. So a borrow and spend mentality from the government should be your base case. It doesn't matter which party. I genuinely believe that the government is going to borrow and spend here over the next few years to try to get inflation back up, because it's already fallen too much to allow the debt to GDP to rise. Last thing I want to talk about here is money markets. SOFR volumes continue to tick up, but the reverse repo program continues to tick down. It will put the Fed's balance sheet in play. We feel QT is coming to an end sooner than later, and that will only make way for balance sheet expansion. So here on this next chart, I have reverse repo in green and the foreign facility in orange. You can see that the Fed's reverse repo facility has declined and is basically at a level that cannot continue to fund the increase in SOFR. We saw SOFR above $2 trillion. This is now only about $700 billion. There's not enough money here to account for all that increase in SOFR that might be coming as dealers continue to finance more and more inventory of Treasury securities. What does that mean? The Fed itself is going to house some of these Treasury securities, and we will see QT end, the end of QT2 here, and the beginning of QE5. But the Fed, of course, might not call it QE, more likely to call it nominal GDP targeting or GDP targeting of the balance sheet. Thank you guys for sticking with me for this long global macro update. The bitcoinlayer.com/subscribe for our free research publication. Subscribe to our channel here, and we'll catch you guys next time.